Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Movie Geeks United. Tonight, a horror movie spectacular, featuring the star of the upcoming horror movie smash, Saw 4, Lyric Bent. Plus, a look back at one of the most influential horror films of our time. Cinematographer Daniel Pearl and documentarian David Gregory speak to the enduring legacy of the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Got a question for any of tonight's guests? Give us a call at 718-508-9477 or log on to our chat room now. Sit back, grab the popcorn, and get ready to get your geek on. Here are your hosts for tonight's episode of Movie Geeks United, Jamie and Jerry.
Welcome to Movie Geeks United, a great show tonight for all the horror fans out there, and this is the month for it. I am one of your co-hosts for the evening. My name is Jamie, and we have Jerry here as well. Hey, Jerry.
Hey, what's up, man? This is going to be a great show.
I know. I'm so psyched about this show.
I'm very psyched. I'm very excited right now.
Because first of all, it's a no-brainer. Saw 4 this weekend will be the top film.
Yeah. Oh yeah, I would be really shocked if it's not.
And speaking of the top film in the horror genre, no horror film has affected me more than the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Oh dude, that film! The first time I saw that, I was supposed to be studying for a geometry final in high school, and we rented that. This was like '86, I think.
Yes.
Oh man, the hell was geometry? I mean, oh dude, that film was.
Yeah.
It's one of the best, you know?
Yeah, with or without Texas Chainsaw, I would say to hell with geometry.
Oh, yeah, I mean, we would have watched something else regardless. But
Yeah. But I remember watching it when I was a kid, and it just had such an impact on me. I'd never seen something so terrifying. And every film pales in comparison to it for me.
But
it was so visceral and unrelenting when I first watched it, and it still is, but watching it again as an adult, I begin to really see the craftsmanship and,
mm-hmm.
and the artistry in it, and how it comes to be that it is so effective.
Oh, it is. I mean, the scene where you first see Leatherface and he comes out of that door,
yeah,
still one of the great entrances.
Yeah, it
I mean,
absolutely
just really.
Is. And a great sequence, the prelude to that sequence,
mm-hmm.
that amazing shot underneath the swing there, and we're
yes.
going to be talking about that tonight with our first guest. A couple of notes before we get started tonight. You can subscribe to our show through iTunes. Just click on the Subscribe to iTunes button on the Blog Talk Radio homepage, or type us up, Movie Geeks United, in the search engine of the iTunes program. We've got some great programming. You can access all of our archived shows, including the one we just did Sunday night. Our tribute to Stanley Kubrick has been going over really well. Lots of replay listens from brand new listeners. So
that was a great
horror-related shows as well, including our Blair Witch Project reunion. We did an eighth-year anniversary reunion of the filmmakers with the co-stars, and it was quite a show. So look back a couple of months ago, I believe that was an August show, and you'll find that. We have a lot of great guests coming up on Movie Geeks United. This weekend, this Sunday night, we have some directors and cast members and representatives from After Dark Films speaking about the this year's Eight Films to Die For series. So that'll be our final horror-related show for the month. And then on Halloween, of all nights, it's not a horror-related show. We have legendary producer A. Kitman Ho. You might recognize that name. He produced a lot of Oliver Stone's work, including Platoon and JFK. And we also have screenwriting guru Blake Snyder. And the following Wednesday, we just confirmed composer Mark Isham. He's done a lot just this
season. Oh, yeah. I mean,
Reservation
goes way
Road.
Back.
Lions for Lambs, The Mist, a great artist, and we're so proud to have him on our show. That'll be next two Wednesdays from now, actually. Okay, but tonight, it's all about the Saw.
It's all about Saw and Texas Chainsaw.
It really is. Our first guest tonight is one of the most accomplished and talented cinematographers in the business. So accomplished and talented, in fact, that three of his works have found their way into the Museum of Modern Art, including his very first feature film effort, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre. In addition to his unforgettable work in feature films, including the 2003 remake of Chainsaw Massacre and the upcoming Christmas Day release of Alien vs. Predator Requiem.
I'll be there that morning.
That's right.
You think I'm joking. I'm not.
That's what Christmas is all about. He has long been a leading innovator of the music video landscape, lending his considerable talents to many hundreds of works, from The Police's Every Breath You Take, to Michael Jackson's Billie Jean, to Janet Jackson's All For You. It's a legendary cinematographer we have here tonight. He's received a plethora of prestigious awards and honors, including the Kodak Vision Hall of Fame Award for Music Video Cinematography, the Music Video Producers Association Lifetime Achievement Award, and the AICP Best Commercial Cinematography Award for his work on the now classic Motorola Wings ad, which incidentally is another one of his works to be included in the Museum of Modern Art.
Oh.
It is a tremendous honor for us to welcome cinematographer Daniel Pearl to our show. Mr. Pearl, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Good evening, Jeremy, David, horror fans. I want to say a special hello to someone out there, my daughter, Nikki.
Oh, great, great. Well, thank you so much for being with us tonight. It's a great honor to speak with you, and I'm not kidding. This the original Chainsaw Massacre, absolutely. I feel like it changed my life, and I'm sure you get that quite a lot from rabid fans out there. But I was surprised to learn, or actually not quite surprised, but you were right out of college when the opportunity to shoot Texas Chainsaw came about, weren't you?
That's correct. You know, at the time, I started in the film school in about 68, and at that time they told us, and it was true at the time, that there were very few opportunities to actually break into the film business.
Yeah.
So if you were passionate about the cinema, if this is what you love, really what you would do is get your undergraduate degree, go on and get a graduate degree, eventually become a professor, teach films, and hopefully you get to make films on the weekends or in the summers and get a grant. I was pursuing that path. I got both a bachelor's degree and a master's degree at the University of Texas. And right as I finished my master's degree, I told my close friends, that we were all making student films together. I said, you know, guys, I actually think that I might be able to crack it and get into this business. I think I could shoot a film by the time I'm 35. I was 23 at the time. And about 3 weeks later, Toby Hooper called me up and offered me to shoot what was known at that time as Leatherface, but became the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Wow. That's quite something right there. I know the picture was made on a pretty shoestring budget, but were there a lot of discussions on the visual look of the picture prior to shooting?
Well, yeah. I mean, Toby and I talked about it a lot throughout. You know, we both doing. You know, he had a look, and I had. You know, he basically hired me because he liked the way some of the commercials that I had shot for students who had already graduated. I'd done a few commercial jobs, and you know, it just worked out. We got together, we started talking about it. Some of it had to do with the situation. You have to keep in mind, as a cinematographer, 23 years old, I thought I knew a lot. I didn't really know as much as I thought, but there's a lot of intuition there that comes to play in the look of the movie and especially the designing of the shots and the compositions.
Yeah. And a lot of people comment on the documentary feel of it. I mean, it absolutely feels real and authentic at every moment.
This is absolutely true, you know, and it was essential to Toby that we shoot with his handheld style. And at that time, for the film buffs out there, they had only just recently, about a year prior to that, invented lightweight 35mm cameras that were quiet enough to shoot with sync sound. So we tried for those. We were a very small budget. As you said, a shoestring budget. Our budget, in fact, believe it or not, was $80,000.
Oh.
We got that film in the can and partway through the lab for $80,000.
Wow.
Mm. Anyhow, we chose to shoot 16. I have to say that some of it might actually be a bit of chance, you know, to me, or a bit of luck that I didn't know that much. I wasn't that sophisticated of a lighter. I didn't know that much about it at the time. And so that probably also helps give it that documentary and verite feel.
Yeah.
You know, as you probably know, I shot the remake in 2002. And I went very different there. You know, I went for a totally different look and tried to give it much more of a look and a style that that I thought would be appealing to what I consider now to sort of be the MTV viewing audience.
That's true, and I definitely want to talk to you about that one, because the visuals in the remake as well are, you know, it sounds strange because you're talking about the horror genre, but they're gorgeous, your photography in that remake as well.
Thank you.
But in terms of the original, were there cinematic inspirations that you looked to, that you and Toby looked through to draw upon?
Well, you know, this is before VCRs and things like that, so that wasn't as easy as it is today.
Yeah.
Today, reference. In fact, in my opinion, there's probably too much referencing of other works.
Yeah.
But you know,
movies are like that now.
Yeah.
Sorry?
Whole movies are like that now, and just like scenes from other movies. I mean,
yeah.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, that's just become very much, because it's so easy now to get your hands and lay it, you know, and have a look at whatever. You know, it's instantaneous. This is the world we live in. So those days, the VCR hadn't been invented. You had to be lucky enough to be in a place where they were showing a film if you wanted to see it. That was your only chance.
Right. Now, tell me about the two most famous shots, or at least the two most impressive ones for me in the film. And of course, the first one, it has to be the dolly track under the swing, where you follow the girl into the house after Kirk is, you know, taken a beating. How did that shot come about? That was not pre-planned, was it?
No, it's quite an interesting thing. We had shot for 1 week. You know, we were young filmmakers.
Mm-hmm.
That we had a lot of imagination. Fortunately, we had good intuition. But, you know, still, we're beginning filmmakers. It was declared by the producers after 5 days of shooting that we weren't moving quite fast enough for them, and that they shut us down for 1 week and instructed Toby to write a shot list. They wanted a complete shot list of every shot that was going to be made in the whole movie. Therefore, they could schedule a shooting and basically put us on do a giant math problem and put us on a schedule to get it done.
Mm-hmm.
Unbeknownst to me, Toby did that, but it was just sort of as a placebo. It wasn't really a real shot list, which became apparent to me about a half a day into it, and to the producers about 2 days into it. Now, this brings us to the third day we're back, and it's the day we're shooting that scene, exterior behind the swing. We shoot the whole scene, and as we finish it, I get this idea. I go, Toby, you know, that we have a dolly track that we basically have a platform dolly, which is, you know, for those of you out there, it's a track, kind of like a railroad track, like your train tracks that you might have had when you had a model train set. Bigger scale, it's probably about 32 inches wide, about 2-inch diameter pipe. I had 60 feet of that track. The whole film was made with just 60 feet of track. And I realized that I could lay down on that platform, hold my 16-millimeter camera off the front edge of the platform, I had a hard line because we're shooting one letterbox aspect ratio of 1.85, width to height ratio. I have a hard line at the bottom that I knew I could, that if I tilted the camera up and didn't show the track, that I could fit underneath the swing. So I described the shot to Toby. He said, you know, it'd be a great shot. Terry McMinn will look fantastic from behind like this. And as we dolly in, the house will grow and grow and grow on this 8-millimeter, which is a fairly wide-angle lens. Not extreme, but definitely a wide-angle lens.
Yeah.
The house will grow and grow and grow until basically it just envelops the frame.
And
Toby
that,
goes.
And that is why that shot is so terrific. Not
it's
just
right.
Because not just because of the technological aspect of it.
Right.
But
no.
Thematically, yeah, it works for the scene.
Absolutely about that. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Toby, he got almost starry-eyed. He goes, damn.
I bet.
That's just it. You know, so set up to do it, right? Well, the production, about 15 minutes into making the set, I think, what are you guys doing? Well, you know, we're making, you don't have another shot on the list, move on, it's not on the list, you got to move. Toby, God bless him, says, guys, I'm the director, he's the DP, you step out of my way, you cannot stop us, we're making a shot. They fire us while we're doing it, but we're making a shot. He goes, it's too important to the movie, you cannot stop it.
And thank goodness he did, because, I mean, 30 years later, we're still talking about it.
You know, people, I'm very proud of that shot. You know, I've been introduced. Someone introduced me back when Spielberg was doing 1941. Somebody introduced me to him, and he went, Daniel Pearl, you shot the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Put his arm around me, started leading me off the set, walking away from his set that he was shooting on, and started asking me, how'd you come up with that idea for that dolly under the swing? It's incredible.
Oh, wow.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's something else. Another thing I wanted to ask you about in terms of a particular shot in the film, and this might come from the kind of experimentation that you were doing on this film. The shot at nighttime, the car, where the father is beating the hitchhiker in front of the lights of the car.
Thank you.
just incredible shot.
Thank you. I'm very proud of that, and it's, that's, you know, you can trace that right through to the kind of stuff I'm shooting today. I'm still doing that same kind of thing, you know.
Yeah.
It, you know, you got a bit of something in the atmosphere, whether it be dust or haze or fog or you know, whatever. In that case, it's dust. You know, and it just becomes very strong and graphic, and you know, and a lot about, you know, if you think about it, things that are kind of scary, and if you don't see things too clearly, they're scarier, they're more interesting, and you as a viewer, you contribute, you participate, you fill in the blanks on what you can't quite see. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's the technique that we use throughout the film, and that's just one of the places where we've done it.
Yeah, amazing, amazing work. Now, when you're doing it, could you feel on the set that this was going to be something something special, something that worked?
I have to say that when I read the screenplay, I was absolutely mind blown. I could not believe that I was being asked to be involved in something like this.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't believe that ultimately I would shoot it. I thought it would go away. And after I read the screenplay the first time, I called Toby back. I tried to play cool. Of course, I'm like, you know, electrified. I can't even believe that this opportunity has come my way. I'm 12 years ahead of my schedule.
Yeah.
35, right?
Right. You
know? And when I shot my first picture. So I tried to play it cool with Toby. I said, Toby, so when do we start? He goes, well, Daniel, he goes, I got an $80,000 budget, and at the moment I have $70,000 from one backer. And as soon as we get the other $10,000, we start, right? So we're living in Texas, and there's, you know, some people, sometimes pretty wealthy people in Texas at this time.
Right.
And so I hung up the phone. I'm going, oh, my God, this movie is too good on paper. They'll get a guy from Hollywood out here. I'll lose this job. I had a friend, wealthy guy, who was a film buff. I called him up. I asked him I told him I'd been asked to shoot a film. Would he like to read the screenplay? He did. He called me back 3 hours later. He loved it. He put up the money, and away we went.
Oh, wow.
So now, to answer, more directly answer your question, it's an interesting story. I felt like I was compelled to tell it to you guys. I hope you don't mind. But to more directly answer, you have no way to estimate that anything is quite as big as this. You know, that's going right into the Museum of Modern Art, that people are going to be talking about it 34 years later, right?
Yeah.
No, there's just no way to estimate that. If you did, you probably wouldn't believe it, if you thought that to yourself. So, I mean, we thought it was good. We thought it was great. We thought it was interesting. And you know what else? We thought it was funny.
It is funny, yeah, and you don't get that until repeat viewings. I mean, obviously, you're so preoccupied with just being terrified by it when you first watch it, but the humor is something that does come across the more times you watch it.
Yeah, no, it's totally meant to be humorous.
Yeah.
Interestingly, though, the same crew, the next job we had after this, we got hired to shoot a commercial for the state of Texas that Don't Drink and Drive. Supposed to be at the scene of a accident. We arrive afterwards, and the whole thing, you see this ambulance pulls up, and there's all these cuts of the accident scene, and in the end, it tilts down, you see martini glass on the ground. Well, when we shot it, we used so much blood and shot it with blood spurting out of veins and things like that. The Texas Department of Public Safety said, y'all sick. You guys are all sick. We can't put this on television. We're all going like, wow, what are you talking about? This? You know, so it was pretty intense to make it, but we definitely got into the mode and, you know,
so,
got on it.
So I know the remake, the 2002 remake. It was directed by a longtime collaborator of yours, Marcus Nespo.
Correct.
Now when he approached you to do it, were you apprehensive at all?
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny. Around that time in my life. See, my daughter would have been 15 years old, right? And I actually, at about 3 years earlier, that saying, well, you know, I have a different take on life now. I'm a father, I have a daughter, and I'm not sure I'd make that movie if it was offered to me today, right? And I've been saying that on panels that I've been on, you know. I said, yeah, you know, I enjoy doing it. It's great fun to shoot it, but I'm just not sure that, you know, I would make that film today.
Right.
Well, then I get this call from Marcus, and as you said, yeah, I've been shooting a lot with Marcus for probably 8-9 years before that. He had He had heard many Texas Chainsaw Massacre stories. I had no idea he was even up for the job. He called me up. I was shooting a music video in Montreal, and my cell phone rang. It was Marcus. He goes, "Listen, I just signed on to shoot the remake of Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Will you shoot it for me?" I right away said yes. And then I thought, why did I just say yes? I've been telling people I wouldn't do this if it came up again, but he's a great filmmaker, a great guy to collaborate with. I knew he would make a great film, and I knew together we would really do a good job of it.
Yeah. Well, when you said that you wanted to take a completely different approach from what you did on the original, what exactly was involved with that? What was your vision for the look of this one?
Well, it's kind of strange. Obviously, it's funny because I was interviewed many times, and in fact, the producer said the same thing to me as we were ramping up the production and I was on prep. They went, "Well, so it's going to be gritty and grainy like the original." And I went, "No." I mean, "What do you mean, no?" And I'm going, "Well, guys, I've done that." And really, this is also something that Marcus Nispel knew. He knew that I'd done that. He knew that I was the one cinematographer that could remake this film without trying to knock off the original. Because I'd done that. I didn't need to do it. Right? So we came up with this other visual approach. Now, as much as anything else, there's just an angle of light that I like. I'm a cross lighter. I like to lift texture and things and play with not so much fill, keep it contrasty, keep it dramatic.
Yeah.
Graphic compositions, graphic light, lighting with smoke. So in a way, I do what I did. Okay? I did what I do. Right? And that's the style. But at the same time, it's also, as much as anything else, it's tempered by the schedule that we're on. And so I do what I do to the best of my ability with the time that I have to get it done in. And it's really, it's hard for me to talk about in terms of a style because it's not born out of any other film or anything else that I've seen. It's just kind of the natural sort of feeling that I have about light, where light should be placed. And it's pretty straightforward.
And it's interesting how you say that it's not predicated on the look of any other films, because that's what I was taken by when I saw the remake that you shot, and now I'm taken by how every similar movie tries to emulate that look that you created.
Yes, they do. I know.
Yeah.
That's flattering, but the way I say it, and I hope we don't get bleeped or shut down for it, but I don't like to refer to films. I'll refer a little bit to films I've made, but still don't beat that to death.
Right.
But films that other people have made, because I prefer to think that my work comes from my head or my heart and not from my ass.
Yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And the film, I'm not schooled on cinematic terminology, so forgive me. But the color scheme seems to be very kind of seeped in kind of tobacco hues. And
yeah, there's some brilliant work there by a production designer, Greg Blair, who, got in there. Excellent locations. I'm sorry I don't actually know the location scout's name, but he found this fantastic locations that had been selected prior to me even coming on board the picture. And that just helped set a tone. It just looks great, Texas is good. You come here, you got some humidity, you get, things get funky, to get a patina on them just naturally with age. It's kind of like, it's not quite as good as New Orleans, but it's a place that just gets, as things get old, they just take on a texture and a color, and it's fantastic for film.
Yeah, and Texas has really blossomed in terms of film production.
Absolutely.
Yeah, big time.
I'm actually here at the moment in Texas.
Oh, yeah. You're. Did you grow up in Texas? Is that where you're from originally? Or?
In 2 days, I start another film here.
Oh, wow. I want to talk to you a little bit about your other work before we wrap this up. But music videos, you've made such an indelible impression with your work in music videos. And I see today, and I'm sure everyone else does too, how music videos have kind of integrated themselves into feature films. The fast-cutting, just nonstop kind of gorgeous imagery. Do you find that this is a double-edged sword, or do you think it's entirely a good development, or what?
Well, I think it's a good development, and the thing in music videos, it's a fabulous place to work because they're short films, right? So you can gamble on a look, on a technique, and you just got to pull it off in 4 minutes.
Right.
So that's why I think it's been sort of a natural place to be the birthing ground for so many visual techniques and effects. You know, we can give it a go. First of all, even before that, we're urged to do something different, eye-catching and different. It's got to be. You know, it's like almost the rule that, you know, every music video has got to somehow go someplace. If it's going to be a great one, it's got to go someplace that you've never been before, you know. So we're always looking for something new. We're always looking for some way to make it cool and unique, right? So there's that. And then, like I said, because you only have to sustain it for 4 minutes, you know, at most, you know, you can gamble. You can roll the dice. You can't. You wouldn't want to try and totally pioneer a new technique and see if it works on a $10 million movie, you know, because if it doesn't work, it's $10 million out the window.
Yeah. Well, but you were in the music, you were part of the music video revolution fairly early.
Well, thank you. Yeah, that's, you know, it's kind of, it actually ties back to this purpose of this interview, the main thread of this interview. There was a director in 1982. In 1982, the music video business was basically an English industry. There was a show, Old Grey Whistle Stop and Top of the Pops, and they knew that if you would put it was called a clip or a promo at that time. If you put a promo on, if you had a song in the top 10 in England or Australia, and you put a promo on the air, your album sales would go 5x the next week, and then 4x, 3x, 2x back to what you had before you started this.
Right.
So it was a pretty straight economic decision, financial decision, to produce a promo. Initially, that's how it started. And it was, like I said, an English industry. Well, an Australian director had gone to London, a guy named Russell Mulcahy. He actually directed the original Highlander.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Russell was very much the man in music videos. He was doing, you know, Duran Duran and, you know, it just goes on and on, a list of great music videos he was doing. He was undisputedly the guy. Well, he was actually happened to be a huge Texas Chainsaw Massacre fan.
Mm.
And had a falling out with whoever was shooting for him over some reason. And all of a sudden, needed a new cinematographer in Los Angeles, you know, in 2 days. I live in Los Angeles. The producer rang me up. This is Daniel Pearl. I went, yeah, just the Daniel Pearl shot Texas Chainsaw Massacre? Yes. Well, Russell Mulcahy would love to, you know, have a meeting with you. So, now, this is virtually 10 years after I shot Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And in that time, I've been shooting sort of B-movies, principally is what I was doing with B-movies in Los Angeles. And we went off and made this music video. When it was done, he took me to a telecine machine, which is where we transfer the film to videotape, and so they can edit using video technique.
Yeah.
That's basically why music videos are called video, because that's where they do all their editing. And then took me to a party and introduced me to Godley and Cream, Steve Barron, you know, and on and on. All the English directors, there happened to be a dozen of them at this party on Sunset. Mm-hmm. And they all just started hiring me right away. Next thing I was shooting Billie Jean, you know, Michael Jackson's Billie Jean, and The Police, Every Breath You Take. And you're just off and running. And it stuck, you know, cause I was fortunate to get good jobs, work with good directors, and what sort of made me unique was I was a guy who had been a filmmaker for 10 years. Most everybody else had about 2 or 3 years experience and was basically self-taught. So even though still I'm in my early 30s, I was like the film granddaddy to everybody, you know, so 10 years, he knows it all.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was a great place to be. That was a fantastic time for me, and you know, the experimentation, the techniques, it's fabulous, and I still enjoy shooting music videos today.
Yeah, it amazes me, and I'm slightly in awe because you're such an essential part of cinematic history, and also music history. I mean, you think Michael Jackson, Billie Jean, The Police, Every Breath You Take, and all these tremendous talents that you've worked with in the area of music. I mean, you have to look back at your career so far and just, you must be in awe too.
I a year ago, while I was shooting Alien vs. Predator, I was invited to go to Poland. There's a film festival there called Camera Image.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's a cinematography festival. So if anybody out there, if you're interested in cinematography, this film festival takes place immediately after our Thanksgiving in a town called Łódź, south of Warsaw, Poland. And there's about 4,000 or 5,000 people that attend. And every year they give an award for the best photograph feature, the best photograph European feature, and the best photograph Polish feature. And then they give a Lifetime Achievement Award to a cinematographer who's had an illustrious feature career, Owen Roizman, Wilmo Zsigmon, kind of guys, you know, have won these awards in the past. Well, they contacted me and told me that they wanted to expand their festival. They wanted to open up short films into the festival, and when they discussed it, they said, well, really, the best short films are music videos. And then somehow they decided that they would bring this into their festival and kick it off by giving me a Lifetime Achievement Award for my music videos.
Mm.
So, very honored, of course, and I was able to attend that. But the reason I told you all the story was they wanted me to cut together a 45-minute montage of my music videos, my greatest music videos.
Yeah.
So I basically had to relive the previous 25 years of my life. It was really quite an incredible thing to go through, because I had to, you know, get everything digital into Final Cut Pro, and then I was editing it while I was shooting Alien vs. Predator on my days off. And, boy, it really made me think, you know, I was forced to basically really relive my life in some ways, that there is the music video part of it.
Yeah, oh, well. Now, I can't let you go without asking about Alien vs. Predator. From a photography standpoint, I know that a lot of people are excited about this movie, me included. Obviously, it's a film that's steeped in kind of special effects. And how has special effects affected what you do? It's a whole different language, I'm sure, you've had to learn.
Well, you know, first of all, I got to tell the audience out there, the film's directed by the brothers Strauss. It's Greg and Colin Strauss.
Oh.
They're very involved in visual effects. They're owners of a company called Hydraulix, one of the top visual effects companies in Hollywood, or actually technically in Santa Monica. And they absolutely were hired with that in mind. Having said that, once they got on the job, they wanted to do as much as possible in camera and reel, right? So they go, oh, man, we're visual effects, you know, CG'd up to our eyeballs. We're going to do as much as we can reel. And so, consequently, we did a lot. I mean, we had 11-week shoot, 53 days of shooting, I believe, and I think out of that, I spent 3 days in front of a green screen.
Mm.
Those of you who are technically aware of that, a green screen is basically a visual cookie cutter. We film people against a certain shade of green. They then tell a computer to cut what's not that color green out and stick it on top of another background. That might be probably CG, or, you know, it's a way you make people fly. It's a way you put people in locations that they either can't get to or don't exist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Excuse me for that explanation, but I thought that, that's not very much for a film of this type.
Yeah, yeah. That is surprising. We have a caller, and then I promise I'll let you go. You've been so generous spending so much time with us.
We have
someone on the line ask you a question. 757 area code. Go right ahead, 757.
Hey, what's going on, guys?
Hey.
This is Jonathan Moody from the Independent Corner.
Hi, how are you doing?
Pretty good. I had a question for Daniel, if he doesn't mind.
No problem. Go right ahead.
The question is, I noticed that since you've had such a great, like, extensive, film background or whatever, are you ever thinking about directing a movie or doing anything other than just being a DP?
Well, you know, that's interesting. I did try. I did direct 3 music videos. I did, the first one I did was 4-page letter for Aaliyah. And then mm-hmm. I did Honey, Mariah mm-hmm. Carey, Honey, the remix. Which is with P. Diddy, and then I did a Butterfly for Mariah. In the end, there's several reasons about it. I'm really a shooter. That's what I do. My whole reason at that time that I directed was I wanted to have complete control of the camera. I wanted to take the best pictures that I could and shoot everything at the right time of day where the light was beautiful. To do both, and also, every time I tried to hire another cameraman, my two clients, Aaliyah and Mariah, or their management said, no way, you have to photograph the ladies. If you want, we'll hire another director. So basically, the coming out of that experience, you know, I realized that it's really what I do. I'm a shooter. I'm really good at that. And there's one other thing that I realized that when I was trying to be a director, and I'm not really much of a writer, right? I'm a really good backseat driver, and that's as a cinematographer, that's what you are. You're a co-collaborator with a director, and you work with him. And interestingly enough, you know, we as cinematographers, we work quite a bit, and we shoot a lot, and that's important to me. I like to shoot, and directors don't shoot as often, and that didn't appeal to me, the downtime in between the jobs as a director. And you know, it didn't work out, but you know, I don't think it'll ever happen, to be honest with you.
Okay, Jonathan, thank you so much for calling in with your question, man.
Okay, you have a good one.
You too. Bye-bye now.
Talk about it.
Mr. Pearl, thank you so much for spending so much time with us tonight. And
thank
I have
you.
So many more questions to ask you, but please join us again sometime in the near future. I just think you're welcome.
I'd be happy to join you. Thanks a lot, guys. It's been great.
Thank you so much, sir. Bye-bye now.
Take it easy. Bye.
That is Daniel Pearl, the cinematographer of Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the original and the first remake in 2002. Amazing talent, Jerry.
Oh, it was amazing. I was not aware of his music video contribution is something that's going to be written about for a long time
Billy
to come.
Billy Jean, man.
Yeah, I mean, just that alone.
I know. All right, our next guest has been so patient in waiting on the line here, and I'm so sorry to keep him waiting. But I'm so excited about speaking with him as well. David Gregory is here. He's built an impressive career chronicling some of the biggest and most interesting films in the history of the medium, including, of course, Toby Hooper's 1974 classic Texas Chainsaw Massacre. His feature-length documentary on the making of the film, titled The Shocking Truth, catches up with the principal cast and crew as they reflect on the legacy they all helped to create. Mr. Gregory has also recently gone into production on his very own horror feature, I believe, called Plague Town. We've got to ask him about that, too.
Yeah.
It's a great honor to welcome Mr. David Gregory to our show. Mr. Gregory, are you with us?
I am. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you so much for holding here and for calling in. I very much appreciate it.
No problem.
Now, I've seen your documentary many times. Mm-hmm. I'm in love with it. But take me back to the beginning when you first saw Texas Chainsaw. When was that, and what kind of effect did it have on you?
It probably had more of an effect on me than any other movie that I ever saw. And I believe I was 9 or 10 years old, and it was before in England, a lot of films were banned around that time as video nasties, and Texas Chainsaw Massacre was one of them. But I was lucky enough to see it before it was banned with a friend of mine. And what was interesting was that we made great efforts to get as many of the horror movies that were coming out on video at that time. And, you know, the gorier, the better. And what was amazing about Texas Chainsaw Massacre was that it wasn't that gory. And I was, you know, surprised that there was, you know, really not that much bloodshed in it, but it just had this amazing stench about it that really had a profound effect on me. And I realized that there was so much more to horror filmmaking than just, you know, bloodshed.
I feel exactly the same way. It really affected me in the same way. And honestly, I think the most glaringly graphic thing about the movie is its title.
Yes,
but
that's
when,
right.
When you first see it, you're so terrified that you're led to believe you've seen a lot more than you have. But on
that's right. But when you look at the you know, the meat hook scene is a good example where you really do. I mean, you really have witnessed some really pretty hideous violence on screen, and it's just not the spilling of blood that actually necessarily makes something violent or shocking. Mm. You know, it's just the way Leatherface kind of picks Terry McMinn up and just nonchalantly puts her on the hook and then goes about his business while she's kind of just left hanging there, unable to comprehend what's just happened to her, you know, and screaming and realizing that she's not going to be alive for much longer. We never actually see her die, do we? But,
no.
You know, she's kind of hanging there, and it just was something that really was like, wow, I have not seen that before.
And
I've not seen it since.
Absolutely. And it calls to mind Hitchcock's Psycho, the shower mm-hmm. scene, because you see the knife and you see the body, but you never see the knife going in the body.
Right.
But you're led to think that you did.
Right.
That's a real craftsmanship in this film that makes it so effective. Do you think that the era in which it was produced, Vietnam and the economic devastation in small towns, do you think that informed that movie as well?
That informed Chainsaw, for sure, yeah. I mean, I think that the whole spate of classic horror movies that came out in the wake of Night of the Living Dead, you know, had something to do with that. The fact that things got a lot more kind of nihilistic and just brutal, and you know, were really kind of shocking rather than, you know, eerie or scary. You know, so it was definitely something that was going on in the times. But you know, horror movies have always reflected the times that they're made in, you know, right up until today. So I think that's why it's the genre that just keeps on being popular, you know, and will never stop being popular, I don't think.
Yeah. Why do you think these films are necessary? Is this a catharsis that's almost therapeutic in a way?
Yeah, I mean, there are numerous reasons why people want to watch horror movies, and there's a lot of people who don't understand why you would want to watch that kind of thing. But you know, I don't think there's any one reason. I mean, I sit in these kinds of movies and sometimes amused rather than scared. I was watching the new Cronenberg movie last night, and when some guy got stabbed in the eye very brutally, it made me laugh, whereas everybody else was kind of cringing. You know, so you know, people have different reasons for liking horror movies, but you know, one thing's for sure, a lot of people like them, and a lot of people go to see these movies.
Yeah, that's for sure. So what started you on this journey of wanting to make a documentary on the making of this original film?
Actually, it was because my friend and I had the same friend who I saw the film with when we were nine, had actually the option to buy the rights to the movie, because it hadn't been available for a long time in England. It had been banned.
Yeah.
And we were told by the head censor that there's no way it would ever get passed. And this was in, I think, 1999 or 1998, something like that. And we were told it would never get passed. And then that censor retired, so we tried to get the rights again. But by that point, somebody a bit more business savvy than us had kind of jumped in and picked it up when they heard that the censor was leaving. And sure enough, as soon as he left, it was allowed uncut, and miraculously enough, there wasn't a spate of chainsaw murders in England afterwards. And anyway, we were a bit annoyed that we were unable to put it out ourselves, and I was like, damn it, I'm going to do something relating to this film. You know, one of my favorite movies. So I got my credit card out, I got in touch with Gunnar Hansen, and he put me in touch with various other people, and that was, you know, the first making of that I did. But it was literally done with me, two friends, and, you know, a consumer camcorder. And I think you can tell, but, you know, that's kind of in tune with the way the movie was made. It's very kind of raw looking.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Now, were they all game to be a part of it? Was there any apprehension amongst the cast and crew?
There are some people, as you know, that didn't actually make it into the film for reason. I mean, there's been if you've seen The Shocking Truth, there's a lot of bad blood after this film came out, with people, you know, not being paid, you know, mafia distribution and all that kind of thing. So there's a lot of kind of anger amongst the people. But as the years have passed, most of the people have got over it and moved on with their lives, and, you know, are not holding a grudge against Toby Hooper or the production company. But there were a couple that we were unable to get. Ed Neal was the key one, who played the hitchhiker. He was just, and I spoke to him many times, but he was just like, you know, I'm really sick of kind of doing Texas Chainsaw Massacre related stuff and just not being paid. And so he was like, you know, I'm sorry, I just can't do it.
Yeah.
But and then Terry McMinn, the meat hook girl, just wants to have nothing to do with it. So, but other than that, pretty much everybody was willing to do it, and was just very accommodating. I mean, we went to most people's houses, and you know, Paul Partain, who played Franklin, was just the loveliest guy, and you know, had us over for barbecue and all this kind of thing. And anyway, it was a very, very pleasant experience overall.
Now, did most of them, I get the sense that most of them, or at least some of them, were just doing it as kind of a fluke, something to do over the summer, that they didn't have any serious ambitions to pursue this as a career.
Yeah, I mean, I think most of the actors were actors, but they were amateurs at that point. They were mainly students, with the exception of Jim Cito, who played the cook.
Yeah.
Everybody else was just fresh out of college, you know, figuring out what to do with their lives. And Gunnar Hansen, who played Leatherface, I don't think he had any aspirations to be an actor at all. He was just the right size. And so yeah, that's right. It was basically something fun to do. Nobody expected it to become what it became.
Yeah, part of cinema history. they're a lot
yeah.
part of it.
Well, big time, yeah.
Yeah, we got a caller, 512 area code. 512, go right ahead.
Yeah, hi, this is Tim Harden.
Tim!
David, how are you, sir?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you doing?
Great. For those who are listening who probably aren't familiar with my name, I'm the Tim Martin, president of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre Fan Club, and I run some websites out there like TexasChainsawMassacre.net and TCMFanClub.com and also TexasChainsawTours.com. But
those are great websites.
Tim was very important on taking us to various locations and putting us in touch with various people on the making of The Shocking Truth as well.
Yeah, a couple things. First of all, Dale, I just want to thank you one more time for allowing me to be part of the landmark documentary. It's, you know, certainly something that I hold up on my wall. You know, that I'm pretty proud of, and it's going to stand up for a very, very long time. My second comment or question, really, and I'm sorry, it really didn't have too much to do with Chainsaw, but it has to do with your work. I was really impressed with how much you and your company has done as far as documentaries within the last few years. Like, I went to my favorite DVD store a couple of years ago and picked up a DVD called The Shape of Things to Come with Jack Palance.
Mm-hmm.
And popped it on, said, Blue Underground, that sounds familiar. And I played the documentary, and sure enough, there's David Gregory. And I think he also did The Evil Dead. Is that true?
Yes, I did one of the Evil Dead ones. I did the one that was actually about Palace Pictures and their distribution of it, yeah.
Okay, so here's my big question.
Yes.
I would love to see the movie ZPG put out on DVD with Oliver Reed.
Uh-huh.
If you guys could do that, I think that would be totally
awesome. That's a great film.
I will look into it. I'm sure. Usually when people give us a request of some film that's not out on DVD yet, usually means it's owned by one of the studios, unfortunately, and they've just got it hidden in their archives and they never sublicense films. So, but I will. I'll have a look into that, Tim.
Okay. Well, I just stepped in with that comment and also say hi because I think it's been a few years since I talked to you.
Yes.
Any plans on coming to the States at all?
Actually, I live here. I live here now. I live in Los Angeles. So, yeah, I've been living here for not long after I did the Chainsaw documentary. I was brought out here by Bill Lustig, and I did a documentary on the Wicker Man and then came out here to edit it, and they were happy with it. And then I ended up just staying and just doing making-ofs for the next 6 years. So the Chainsaw documentary really kind of just opened a big door for me.
I kind of thought it would. I really did. So my final question, we'll let somebody else talk, but are you still with Blue Underground then, or?
I am not, no. I actually parted ways with Blue Underground last year.
Okay.
And but I still do work for Blue Underground. I still, you know, I did all the documentaries for the Stendhal Syndrome DVD that they just released, and just went over to England and did stuff for Living Dead at Manchester Morgue. So, you know, I'm still working with them, but, you know, they're not releasing nearly as much as they used to. So I just left them for my own company and just shot my first feature film. So
great. Well,
time to move on. Yeah.
If you ever pass through Texas, certainly call me. We'll go out and have a beer or something.
That sounds like fun.
Tim,
right.
Thank you for calling in, man. And your site is fantastic.
Yes, it is.
Very, very much. Really,
I will
really appreciate that a whole bunch.
Thank you so much, Tim. It's TexasChainsawMassacre.net. A great site. And we thank you for calling in, Tim.
All right, thanks.
Thank
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
A lot of fans up there.
Yes.
So getting back to the documentary, now what were your fondest memories of putting it together? Because obviously, as someone who's lived with the movie for so long, this had to be kind of a dream come true for you.
It was absolutely a dream come true, yeah. And it was really meeting so many colorful characters. And I've never, I've done something like 130 making-ofs since that. And no film that I can think of off the top of my head had so many unique characters involved with its making, nor so many unique stories, you know, not just about the making, but also about its distribution and that kind of thing, which is a real... which is just an amazing thing to have as a documentary maker. You know, it really helps with telling an interesting story if the stories behind the film are so fascinating and unique. But yeah, just going out and meeting all the people involved, you know, just as a fan was just a massive thing for me. But also to find out that everybody was so nice and welcoming, and you know, just learning so much about Texans and Texas hospitality and barbecue and things like that. It was just a really great experience.
Yeah, yeah. I learned everything that I need to know about barbecue from Texas Chainsaw. Actually. So,
yeah.
Now tell me about your experiences with Tobe Hooper. What sense do you get from him? What are your impressions of him?
Well, I actually just recently did the last interview I did actually before I did the feature was with Tobe. I just did an interview with him for the DVD of The Funhouse and also for Eaten Alive. And Tobe, I get along with just fine. You know, I did the commentary for Chainsaw 2 which was organized by my friend Michael Felcher. And, you know, Tobe was difficult at first on the documentary, and I had actually started editing the documentary without Toby's participation. I don't know if you've seen that book that came out on the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, but it was, again, without any cooperation from Tobe. And so, yeah, he is quite guarded in talking about this film.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, when you get him, he's completely open and has got very vivid memories. And there's, you know, just a real, another colorful character with who made, you know, a classic film. But anyway, I started editing the show and just thought it will be one of those things where a lot of people talk about him and he's not there to give his first-hand opinion. And then a fax came through at like 3 a.m. in the office where I was editing, and it was just said, "This is Tobe Hooper, call me," and with his phone number underneath it. And I called him and he said, "All right, man, I'll do it, you know. So again, I had to get my thoroughly beaten credit card out and go back to Los Angeles and interviewed him there, and just went for a weekend, did the interview, came back and started re-editing the show to completely changed it to incorporate Tobe.
Yeah. Now, part two is pretty controversial, or at least it was amongst enormous fans of the original. But its reputation is growing into quite a cult classic. What's your take on that second film?
I've always loved Chainsaw 2, and again, that was banned in England, so I actually saw it first in French. I was on vacation with my family in France, and we rented it from the video store, and I thought it was fantastic. I never thought it was, you know, a patch on the original, but I, you know, as far as sequels go, that was the right thing to do. It didn't try and top the original as far as, or even replicate the original stylistically. Yeah. It basically took it in a completely new direction. And I mean, the one thing that there's a few things that annoy me about it. I don't like the soundtrack in the film. The film's too big. It should have been made on a much smaller scale.
Right.
You know, it's way too kind of overproduced, and you know, the set design is not Bob Burns' set design. It doesn't seem like, you know, a killer's lair. It seems like a kind of, you know, outrageous movie set.
It's a set.
But you know, overall, it's a very over the top movie. And I would say that actually probably had more influence on, you know, Rob Zombie's first movie than the original Chainsaw, if you look at it stylistically, you know. It's very grotesque.
Yeah, I think so too. Now, since Chainsaw, have there been, do any horror films come to mind that kind of approaches the kind of power that Chainsaw had?
There are others which are dark, like, you know, Suspiria, The Evil Dead, the first one. what else? Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer.
That's what I was going to ask you about, because you actually did the making of documentary on him.
I did.
That seems to me like the last movie that truly kind of reached Chainsaw Heights.
Yeah, that's actually how I convinced MPI that it needed a proper documentary doing about it. I was like, this is the last, you know, this is the last great horror movie in my opinion. I don't think there's been anything since then that's even approached it. So, but even having said that, I don't think they reached the heights that Chainsaw did, or that certainly don't have the enduring influence that Chainsaw does. If you look at modern horror movies, you know, no film is more influential than Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Yeah, agreed, completely. Now tell me before you go about you're directing your own film now.
Yes, I just finished shoot principal photography. I've just started editing.
How did you take to that? How did you find the experience?
Oh, I loved it. Yeah, I mean, it's been something that I wanted to do, you know, since before I actually got sidetracked doing the documentaries, because it just kind of took off after the Chainsaw documentary, and I always wanted to do, you know, narrative films, and, you know, the script was written a few years ago, and I've been talking with Dark Sky Films about it for a while, and ultimately they came around and said, okay, let's do it. They wanted to get into production. They've been doing, you know, of all the DVD labels out there, the Blue Undergrounds, the Anchor Bays, and things like that, they're the ones who are really kind of now carrying the baton for horror movies, and they are releasing some new ones like Antibodies and Them and things like that. So they wanted to get into production, and I was like, well, do I have a film for you? And it's a movie called Plague Town, and it's about a small village of homicidal deformed children. And it was shot in Connecticut over the last month and a half, and it'll be ready sometime next year.
Next year. And when you were directing it, did you call upon your experiences with interviewing makers of the movies like Chainsaw and Henry that you have?
Black House and The Last and things like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been involved in the kind of making ofs on most of those low budget. Classic horror movies, and certainly, you know, learning those people's experiences on their first movies was invaluable help to me in terms of just how to deal with you know, a low budget horror movie that's shot on location. But, you know, it's, I mean, you only know when you actually get out there how the experience is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And with all those films that we just mentioned, you know, everybody's low-budget experience is a little bit different for various reasons. And, you know, I was very fortunate on Plague Town to have a cast and crew who were really into it, you know, despite the fact that we were shooting all nights, all exteriors, and really long hours, and all those, you know, filmmaking things that you have to deal with. But everybody was, you know, completely behind the project. So it was actually a very pleasant, if tiring experience.
Yeah. So that's in post-production right now?
Yes, it is. I just started the editing yesterday.
Okay, great. Well, we will definitely look out for that. And when that comes around, please come back and join us. We'd love to have more time with you on the show.
Oh, fantastic. I'd love to.
Well, thank you so much for joining us tonight,
yes,
Mr.
Thank
Gregory.
You.
Thank you so much.
No problem. My pleasure.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
That's David Gregory, director of the documentary, the definitive documentary on the making of Texas Chainsaw, The Shocking Truth, which is actually included in the recent 2-DVD special edition of the film. Great guests, great discussion on the classic movie.
Yes.
Just one that absolutely rocked my world.
Yeah, I mean, no, it's the definitive horror film, I think.
Yeah. So now we're about to move from one Saw to the next. We are awaiting the call from Lyric Bent, the star of the new Saw 4. And as soon as that call comes through, we will patch him right in. And I know there are a lot of anxious people in the chat room. I can see them now.
They're waiting. They're waiting. They're ready.
We appreciate everyone joining us on the chat room tonight.
And, yes, we do.
Hope you enjoyed the discussion on the Chainsaw Massacre as well. So we'll get to Lyric. As soon as he calls in, we'll patch him in. The Saw films. Now, this, Jerry, is just an amazing success story.
I mean, they were hype. I mean, there was a lot of buzz before, and it's a horrible word to use probably before, but there was a lot of hype before these film, the first one came out. I mean, I remember a couple months everyone was raving about this film. And, you know, look, I mean, we're on the fourth film, and the fourth film is probably going to do better than the first three combined.
Right.
I mean, and there's already a five and six already in the works.
That's true. They're writing them and,
yeah,
and producing them consecutively.
Yeah, I mean, and I don't think it's not going to run out of steam anytime soon. I notice, you know, you look at the other movies that are being released, everyone's scared to release anything on this to compete with this film. I mean, the only thing I think that's opening wide is Dan in Real Life, which is counter-programming. But otherwise, you know, it's the slate's clear. I wouldn't want to open up against a Saw film.
Yeah, well, they keep on doing better. I mean, didn't the last one open at something over $30 million?
Yeah, it was amazing. They, like, make their money back in one weekend.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And for them to go straight into production on 5 and 6, I mean, that says something about the power of the franchise.
Absolutely.
That also might speak to the impending writer strike.
Oh, that's true too. That's,
yeah, which
true.
we will cover in a future show. But in terms of its influence on the genre, I mean, you talk about all these influential genre films, Texas Chainsaw, you know, there's a couple of others, but and the endless imitators that follow in its path. I mean, you already see that with Saw, you know.
Yes, you do.
Yeah, and there's just something missing from the imitators.
Oh, always. There's always something missing from the imitators. And I think you see it, it's between the Saw and the Hostel films are competing with each other.
Yeah.
And but I think the Saw films will win out. They seem to be it just seems like if it's October, it's a Saw month. You know, I mean, it's just, that's what it's going to be like for the next couple of years. There's going to be a new Saw film every October for Halloween.
Yeah, and they have this month, you know, booked out for Saw.
Yeah.
It's absolutely reserved for the Saw.
Yeah, I wouldn't, like I said, I wouldn't want to open against it.
Yeah, what strikes you about the Saw movies? I mean, they're incredibly effective. And obviously they really deliver the goods for, you know,
notch it up for each film. I mean, you know, some films get very complacent with each Roman numeral.
Yeah.
Not the Saw films. They really ratchet it up. They really want to make sure that you, when you go in, there's going to be a sequence in there. You're going to walk out and remember. That's going to really, like, you know, say, wow, how'd they do that? Or that really grossed me out, or something along those lines. I mean, they really go over the top, but they do it in such a way that they know, hey, these guys are going to be back here next October.
Yeah.
And they're right. I mean, they're absolutely right.
At the same time, I know that Lyric, who we're still waiting for him to call in. If he doesn't call in a little bit, I'll make a call to his representative. But it also inspired the term torture porn, which may or may not be fair.
Right.
And we'll definitely get Lyric's take on this. But it is a whole movement now and a controversy unto itself.
It's a controversy unto itself, but I noticed that because when that term really, after the David Edelstein article in New York, and then with the underperformance of Hostel 2 and even the more underperformance of Captivity, a lot of people, you know, there's a famous New York Times editorial that horror movies are dead, which I don't, obviously 30 Days a Night and the Halloween remake definitely repudiate that article, and I don't think, I mean, no genre, the horror genre is one of the most resilient genres there is.
It never dies.
It never dies.
It's
the name of a sequel somewhere, one of the or a tagline somewhere, but I would never bet against it.
Yeah.
Never.
And why do you think that is? Why do you think it's a genre that survives so much?
We like to be scared. We like to be scared by something that's not, you know, it's really fun. and I'm gonna. If I go out, then you can cut me off if you want.
We're waiting for the phone call, so go right ahead.
Okay.
Go off.
We like to be scared. I think we don't like to be scared as a movie-going audience. We don't like to be scared realistically by stuff maybe about the current events, but we like to be scared by like the horror, like a serial killer or a supernatural. We like something that's not so tangible, maybe, in our everyday lives. We don't, you know, like there's these films about the war and about current events don't do too well, but we love to be scared.
Yeah.
And I think that has some, we really do like there's something there, whether it's like a serial killer or a supernatural force, we do like that.
Well, it's just another of the of the genres that speak to the magic of movies. You know,
yes,
you,
absolutely.
The lights off and you, it seems like a genre when it's well done, you can completely lose yourself in.
Absolutely.
And there's more roller coaster of emotions involved in a horror film than, you know, than any other genre when it's
done well. That's true. Even the films, like we had one of the actresses on a couple weeks ago for I think she was in the last Final Destination film. Those films, as silly as they may be, people like to go see them. They're always number one. And when they come out, and I don't know if there's a fourth one in the works or not, but people do like, the, you know, on a Friday night, a weekend film, you know, when you're out of high school or college, you know, for the week or work, people like that. There's an escapism factor there.
Mm-hmm.
And people really do like that.
Yeah, I agree. We have so many guests in the chat room now awaiting Lyric's appearance on the show.
Hell, I'm awaiting this.
I'm telling them, they're talking about how nervous they are, so I'm telling them that they can always type their question if they're too nervous to
right.
call in. I'm like, you know, I'm conducting the interview, and I'm the one that's nervous. okay, it's 7 minutes past the hour, so let me give a call to the representative, because I know that he just flew in into New York today, I believe.
Okay.
And so his flight might have been delayed or something might have happened. I confirmed earlier today, but there's no telling with the flights and such. So
right.
I'm calling the cell phone of the representative, and let's see what happens.
Live radio, anything can happen.
I know. That's what's exciting about this show. I can just... All right. All the listeners out there can join in on the inner workings of the show here. I'm going to set the phone down so I can talk on the other ear.
Okay.
I'm sorry, there's probably dead silence because I set the phone down.
Yeah, well, I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to talk about some, maybe I'll just talk about some horror films.
Okay, I'm leaving a message right now. Guys, listen in while I leave this message.
Okay. All right, so we're all looking forward to the Saw film this Friday. I think I speak for everyone listening.
Jamie Duvall with Movie Geeks United.
For this film, and we're all looking forward to this. And we're looking forward to talking to our guest any moment now. But the Saw films are probably the most influential films I've seen in the last couple of years outside of Eli Roth's work. And I know that mentioning Eli Roth's name to some of our listeners rubs them the wrong way, but... That's beside the point. But we do look forward to this Saw film, which I think actually could be the best of the bunch,
yeah.
To be very honest with you.
I left a message.
Okay, I was just talking about the Saw and Hostel films.
I love it when you talk to yourself.
Well, I was talking to everyone. I was hoping someone would call in.
But that's what watching all those horror movies have done to you.
Brain. I watched two horror movies last week, but three horror movies. Actually.
Well, tell me about them. What'd you see?
I saw the 30 Days of Night, which I liked a lot. And
number
I saw
one
two,
opener. Number one opener.
Yeah, number one opener. Vampires are back. And then I saw this this Flight of the Living Dead, which is fun. And I saw Severance.
Mm.
I think it was last week or the week before. And that's all I've seen this month.
You saw Nine of the Living Dead.
It was, it's like, all right, it's obviously a takeoff of Snakes on a Plane, but instead of snakes, you have zombies, and it's a plague outbreak on a plane. It's fun. It's a fun film.
Oh, I see what you mean. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a fun, I read about that actually a month ago on horroryearbook.com, so it's a fun film. I enjoyed it. I won't lie to you.
Yeah. Well, please don't.
I would never lie.
I'm a huge supporter of the horror genre, but there's so many that just it's so often abused with not very good films. But I think the genre gets a bad rap because of all the weak entries in the genre. But
I think you're right.
But I think it's just as valuable and valid as films of any other genre out there.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and if you look back at some of our classic films, you know, movies that are known as some of the best ever made, you'll find the horror films in there, and they're just incredibly influential. And at their best, they do speak to the times we live in.
Oh, absolutely.
And so what better time than right now when we're in the middle of a big conflict and lots of paranoia and all of that kind of stuff going on.
Oh, there's lots of stuff. And, you know, we've actually had, since we've been on the air, we've had a lot of independent filmmakers who have made some really great first films.
Yeah.
And, we've had people on who made the Blair Witch Project, one of the most influential independent films ever made.
That's true. Yeah. And we have talked to them as well. And, you know, it's interesting how I think it's a good genre to break through in, too. It seems to be, for the independent filmmaker, it seems to be the genre of choice.
It does.
Yeah, and I wonder why that is. I'm sure that because there is a real market for it. Both.
There is a market, but I think it's the film, and especially I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to do this, and I hope you'll forgive me for doing this, but a gentleman that we've had on the show before, a friend of mine, Paul Busetti.
Yeah.
He shot, they did some footage this weekend for a movie called Cannibal Cheerleader Camp, and that's a horror film, but, you know, it's a great genre to break into. It's a great thing to play around with, and he knows his stuff, and he has, a respect for the really great horror films, and that's what he wanted to do, like make one of those horror films, because he is upset with the remakes, and the remakes especially of the Asian horror films.
Mm-hmm.
That I keep seeing trailers for these films that I remember watching a couple of years ago, and I'm seeing trailers for films with, you know, and the only thing is they won't have subtitles. You know, so I understand that, but you're right. There's a do-it-yourself mentality with that genre. Just as we were talking with the gentleman earlier about the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, you can do a lot. You can be very creative.
Mm-hmm. That's true. I mean, you really can, and it's a genre that can be done very effectively at low cost.
Absolutely, and you can also, it's great social commentary, as you were saying.
Yeah, while we're waiting for Lyric to call in, I am posting an invitation to all of our chat room people. Give us a call into the show here, 718-508-9477. And just share your thoughts about the Saw films. I know you all are big fans of the Saw franchise, and if you want to share some thoughts with us about your feelings on the films, just feel free to do so. 718-508-9477. So we're going to wait for at least another 15 minutes for Lyric to call in, and once he does, we'll of course give him the full segment. It's very, very tricky sometimes, and I'm sure the movie's 2 days out from being released, and
he's got a lot. He's all over the place.
Yeah, yeah, and I noticed that our friend Tony Farinella interviewed him as well recently. Did you see?
Right. Yes, I read that.
Yeah, it was a fantastic interview.
Yes, it was. Tony always does a good job.
Yeah. So he's really making the rounds. Lyric is, and probably everyone associated with the Saw franchise. It's a big picture. So what? Give me an estimation of what you think it might do this weekend.
45 to 50.
Wow.
And I just made that up, folks. That was not pre-thought. I know a lot of people come in and they think, oh, you know, he's been thinking about this for like 5 months.
The amazing.
No, I just thought of that.
The amazing Kreskin.
he's doing better than I am.
I think we have a caller on the line. I do not believe it's Lyric because they're not the area codes I have, but it might be a listener to share his thoughts on the Saw franchise. 717, go right ahead.
Well, I'm Nick, a Saw fanatic.
Oh, okay, great.
Hey, Nick, how you doing?
Good to hear your voice.
Good. How about you guys?
Good. So, how are you feeling about Saw 4? It opens this weekend. What are you expecting?
Oh my, I'm expecting a whole lot. Like, I am just like, not to really brag or anything, but I'm like a huge dork of the Saw movie.
Okay, that's fine. What is it about the films that keeps you coming back?
Just the fact that the series, like, is just outstanding, and the way he thinks is amazing. Like, I don't know, from, like, a series of any horror series that I've ever seen, like, normally, you know how they have, like, the ones and twos, how they go back and then they have resurrection and stuff?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, they do this all the time.
Yeah, with this one, I feel like they're not going to do that, and that's what I like about it. They're not going to have, like, Saw, Resurrection, Jigsaw, you know, stuff like that, and I hope
Jigsaw's
they don't do
bar
that.
Mitzvah.
Yeah.
Well, this has to be exciting news for you, then. Did you read that 5 and 6 are being scripted and made back-to-back now?
Yes, I heard about that. Like, I read that yesterday, in fact. Like...
Now, do you have a favorite in the series between the first three that all of us have already seen?
You mean like a trap, or just like in the movie?
Well, no, just the movie in general, or the trap. You can give me whatever you want.
Okay, well, I think my favorite would have to be number three.
Yeah.
Because of like when Detective Carey dies, or the angel trap is just my favorite.
Yeah.
Like that one, I think, is just amazing. But everyone seems to like the rack with the black guy.
Right.
Yeah, and I mean, I like that, but it, I don't know, it needs to be a little more gorier, because, like, I don't know, just with Detective Carey, I mean, like, your organs just fell out, and
organs fell out? Oh, my God, we got a future special effects artist with
That's
us
true.
Here.
You know, we didn't have this conversation when we did the Stanley Kubrick show.
Yeah.
It's so weird.
Actually, you know what?
What's
I have
that?
A friend, his name's Zach, and he does masks, and he's amazing at them. He does special effects and stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, he's outstanding, and I was supposed to go see this movie with him on Friday, but he got in trouble, and now I can't hang out with him for 6 months. So.
Okay, maybe weren't supposed to tell us that, but maybe.
No, I mean, like, it's sad because, like, he's really good at special effects, and...
That's a good field to go into, man, especially if you
got
horror
in trouble.
Yeah. So are you going to check it out this weekend at the theater? And what kind of is it, does it play scarier for you when you see it at the theater with other people?
What do you mean, like, first, like, scaring me, like...
Well, you know how, I think the horror movies, when you watch them with a big audience, they're even scarier than when you watch them by yourself sometimes.
Because
the audience reaction makes you even more scared.
Yeah, it tends you up, that's what I think. Because, like, last year when I went to go see Saw 3, like, I went right after school and I'm around 5 o'clock. And, I mean, there wasn't much people there, but it was just me and my friends, and there was a whole row of us. And we watched it, and it was just, like, the fact that we were near the front of it and the fact that it was loud, it was just, it made it creepy. And
yeah, I agree with you, man. Well, thank you so much for calling in, man,
yeah,
sharing your
you
thoughts on Saw. We're going to bring Lyric on as soon as he calls in, and we're trying to get to the bottom of this. But thanks for your support and calling in.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I have a question. Can I call back when he...
When he calls in, you're more than welcome to if you got a question.
Yeah, definitely.
Oh, thank you. I'm like,
we just made this guy's night.
We're going to give it another 10 or so minutes unless I get a call that he'll call in a little bit later. We'll hang in there.
God. I'm like shaking right now. Oh, my God.
All right, man. Well, give us a call back as soon as we bring him on, then.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you, man.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye. Man, there's some major Saw fanatics.
They are major Saw fans. Wow.
Okay, we're still waiting. Let me try another number. Let's is live radio. We just never know.
The live radio, anything can happen, folks.
Yeah, like Michael Berryman. We, if you guys want to search through our archives a little bit later, we interviewed the lead actor in The Hills Have Eyes, the original. And the second you see his face, you know who we're talking about.
Yeah.
Michael Berryman is his name.
Very iconic look. He was also in The Devil's Rejects, too.
Absolutely. And very distinctive looking, very scary and effective in films like that. But just an absolute gentle soul.
Oh, that's very pleasant to talk to.
Talked to him for a long time, had something like a 35-minute conversation.
Yeah, also another thing, and I guess I'll let you go, we interviewed the actress from Wrong Turn 2, which is getting nothing but really great reviews from everyone I've talked to.
Yeah.
I mean, everyone says it's just light years ahead of the original film, and people have just been raving about this film. Every review I've read said, just rent it, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, yeah, I've been surprised by that, too. I'm listening to a recording.
Okay. No, but it has Henry Rollins in it, who I like a lot, and who I listen to a lot of his spoken word and read a lot of his books, and it's just good to see that everyone's, like, raving about his performance in the film.
Yes.
So that is very good to hear, and I'm going to have to check that out one of these days.
They're listing names here.
Oh, they're listening. Oh, great. What is this, the McCarthy hearings or something?
Everybody waiting on the chat room and waiting to call in have been so patient, and we appreciate that.
We do appreciate it. Our listeners are the best. We really appreciate your support through all of this for the last couple months.
Yeah.
All of you have been tremendous, and we really appreciate it.
So let me tell you how this works. I submit interview requests. I see what movies are coming up on the horizon that might be of interest to the listeners, and I submit interview requests. I first contacted for Lyric because I knew that this would be a major film, and he is the central character. He's been involved in the past three Saw films, including this one, starting with Saw 2.
Right.
He is the central character of this one, so I thought that would be the person to talk to. We have to get him on the show. So I first contacted his representative in early September, and we arranged it and confirmed a couple of times. But you know how this is. This is live radio, and things happen.
Anything can happen, folks. I mean, it's just, this is the nature of the business.
Yeah, but we thank everyone so much for sticking in there. We're going to stick it out for another 7 or so minutes. If you have anything that you want to talk about, anything at all, horror movies, Saw-related, while we're waiting to see if Lyric gives us a call, just feel free to do so. Once Lyric does call in, we have a big, at least a 20 to 30-minute segment planned with him.
Yeah, and you're more than welcome to call in with a question.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you have a question for us, I mean, we're really movie experts here, you and I, Jerry.
We're the movie specialists. No, but speaking of horror films,
yeah.
There is, and I think one that all of us, including Chris and Aaron, are excited for, too, on the day before Thanksgiving, The Mist comes out.
Yes.
And I think we're all very excited for this film.
Yeah, and Mark Isham, who we just booked for the show, actually composed The Mist.
Yeah, it's just a gripping trailer, and I think Frank Darabont, who did The Shawshank Redemption and The Green Mile, if anyone can bring Stephen King to life, it's him.
Yeah, and his first full-fledged horror film. You know, he's done the Stephen King books that aren't typical of his style.
Oh, no, yeah, what is the word I'm looking for? The
kind of heartwarming...
Heartwarming, there you go, thank
male,
you.
Male bonding kind of stuff.
I think he's definitely, if anyone can do it.
Yeah,
it's
well,
him.
He's made it very clear that this is a hard R-rated movie. Yeah, because so many movies, and obviously the Saw films are an exception, so many movies now, horror genre, come out PG-13, so they can cater to the widest possible audience.
Oh, yeah.
In the process, they lose a lot of the luster that make horror films effective in the first place.
But there is one PG-13, and it's also based on the Stephen King that I thought was surprisingly good, was 1408.
Yeah, 1408 is fine, and in many ways, it could get by with a PG-13. Because it's told like an old-fashioned ghost story. I mean, it really has that flavor to it.
Oh, yeah. But, no, for a majority of them, you're right, though. The PG-13, and you go online, you read reviews, a lot of really diehard horror fans are really turned off by this, especially people in our age group who grew up with the R-rated films are really turned off by this latest trend, the last 10 years, a PG-13 horror film.
Yeah. Yeah, and the Mist should be really good, because he said that there's no doubt about it, he's going for hard R rating, and that comes out in just a few weeks.
Yeah, dude, Thanksgiving is just around the corner.
Yeah, and perfect movie for Thanksgiving.
Yeah,
I mean, these are the holiday movies we have now. We have, for Thanksgiving, we have The Mist, and for Christmas, we have Alien vs. Predator.
I mean, you couldn't ask for better holiday-oriented films.
I mean, this is really the season of giving.
And taking your guts.
Yeah, giving and taking all your organs. And okay, we're giving our guest another 5 minutes to call in. Now, we air Sundays and Wednesdays, Sundays at 6 p.m. Eastern. We have a guest. We have several guests this Sunday who are connected with the 8 Films to Die For series. I don't know if I'm sure everyone out there, all the horror fans out there, are familiar with it. There are 8 horror films that are considered too
racy, I guess.
Too daring and too extreme for general distribution. So they choose one weekend. I think this year it's 2 weekends to play these 8 films, and it just got a lot of notice last year.
Oh, it did. A couple of our listeners from the beginning wrote great blogs about this the first films.
Yeah.
Did a really good job. Some people went to all 8 films, and very great reviews. And our friend Tainted Meat, but also if you go to Fatally Yours, Movie Pulse, Geeks of Doom, Horror Yearbook, all these guys, they're writing great reviews, and they will have great reviews of these films once again, because unfortunately they're not coming everywhere, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But some of them are really worthwhile checking out.
Well, the DVD releases are
enormous.
Yeah,
you go to Best Buy. If those are empty shelves there. Like after the first couple of days, I mean, people do go in. This is a very loyal following they have.
Yeah. So we're covering 2 films in particular. We're covering a movie called Borderland, directed by Zev Berman. That director will be with us, as well as the producer, and I believe one of the stars of the film as well. And we're also covering a film called Nightmare Man, directed by Rolf Konevsky, and he will be with us as well, too. And we're trying to work out a representative from After Dark Films to come on as well to speak to the other selections that are part of those 8 films.
Right.
So that'll be a great show. Now, if we can rearrange to have Lyric on Sunday evening, we will expand the show by another half hour. And bring him on at 7 p.m. Eastern. Our show starts at 6 p.m. First hour will be dedicated to 8 Films to Die For series, and then we'll bring on Lyric at 7 p.m. Eastern if we're able to schedule that. But we'll definitely be in touch with his representative. I'm sure it was a flight delay or something that held him up. And as soon as we reschedule, we'll let everyone know. Just join us at myspace.com/MovieGeeksUnited. Make sure you're added to our friends list so you can receive blog posting updates and bulletins. As soon as we find out about it, we'll let you know about it too. And plus, that might be good too, because that'll give all the listeners out there the benefit of actually seeing Software.
Right.
Being able to ask more specific questions related to Mr. Ben's work in it. Okay, we're approaching on the end. Jerry, this has been an interesting half hour.
Yes, it has.
A real structured, formatted first hour. We're on fire. We're great. We're ready for Software. And now we've just been fumbling for a half hour. But that's the name of the game, man.
Yeah, that is.
I'm sorry to all the loyal listeners out there, the people in the chat room. We will we'll do our best to have Lyric on the show on a future date when it's more convenient to him. But please join us. We got some great shows up ahead. If you're a fan of Poltergeist, we have a special retrospective on the original Poltergeist film on November 11th. I completely forgot to announce that. With the writer-producer of the first 2 Poltergeist
that's
films.
That's going to be a really good show. I mean, that's also, speaking of Toby and everything, that's just, you know, that film still, all these years later, is still very frightening to watch.
It still works, and we're going to really get to the bottom of something, which is whether or not Toby Hooper actually directed.
I'm going to let you ask that question. I'm not going to ask that question. I'm going to let you ask that,
yeah.
Right?
I mean, yeah, that's a hot-button question.
That is.
But that's what I'm here for. I'm
take,
the
take the hits.
Yeah. Who's a really hard-hitting interviewer? Yeah, I'm the Barbara Walters of.
Yeah, dude, you're the man. I mean,
I'm the Barbara Walters of Movie Geeks United. I make people cry. I think
yeah,
right after.
I think that's gonna be the quote. I'm the Barbara Walters.
Yeah. I think right after I ask him if Tobe Hooper directed it or did Steven Spielberg end up directing it, I'll ask him what kind of tree he'd be. If, you know, take the Barbara Walters thing to the.
Oh my God.
That's the question that she's most famous for.
It is. You're right.
If you're a tree, what tree would you be? Now, how uninteresting does that interview subject have to be? That's actually a question that you consider asking.
Oh, my God.
All right. Well, guys, it's been a lot of fun. Sorry about the mix-up here. We had them confirmed, but I couldn't make it in. So we will make sure that we spend every effort trying to get them back on and reschedule. Until next time, guys, we'll be back with you Sunday night with the 8 Films to Die For show. Thanks for tuning in.
Yeah, thank you.
And we'll talk to you later.
Okay, good night, everyone.